You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, February 13th, 2018.
When we looked at this, we looked at our alternatives. The vehicle that we purchased was that alternative. I think it's really important for people to remember, this is a piece of equipment. It's not our mentality.
Residents spoke with alarm and concern at a press conference this afternoon over the Bloomington Police Department's acquisition of an armored car. BPD Chief Mike Dekoff fielded questions from the audience. We'll have highlights from that meeting in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Scott Ferris's family settled in Indiana six generations ago after suffering religious persecution in England. Ferris's family story is coming up later in the program in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
Kilroy's on Kirkwood in downtown Bloomington is facing a city challenge over its ability to operate in Monroe County. The Monroe County Alcohol Board heard remonstrances, residents speaking against the bar's ability to continue selling alcohol, during an otherwise routine meeting last Wednesday. The Monroe County Alcohol Board meets on the first Wednesday of every month. Several city officials appeared to challenge Kilroy's on Kirkwood's ability to operate an establishment which serves alcohol, including City of Bloomington Communications Director Mary Catherine Carmichael and City Councilmember Steve Olin and Isabel Piedmont Smith. The three-member board announced today they would have to delay a hearing over Kilroy's alcohol permitting until April. The board is comprised of local lawyer Kitty Leal, mayoral appointee Karen Howe Fernandez, and WFIU-WTIU director Perry Metz. Metz says he'll be retiring from the panel.
I agreed to go ahead and serve at the February meeting so that to give them time to get somebody. I'm appointed by the county commissioners, so there will be a new person at the March meeting.
Metz says the board's decision to push back the vote on Kilroy's alcohol permit came after the owners weren't present for last week's meeting and wouldn't be available until April's. He says his resignation has nothing to do with the challenge to Kilroy's on Kirkwood.
You know, 9 years is plenty. And I thought that I would be voting on Kilroy's at the last meeting, but obviously that didn't happen. And now it won't be until April.
The next meeting of the Monroe County Alcoholic Beverage Board takes place on the first Wednesday of March. It's still undecided as to whether or not public comment will be available outside of the remonstrators that called Kilroy's on Kirkwood's permitting into question during the board's April meeting. Metz's position is expected to be filled by the Monroe County Commissioners.
Tonight is the State of the Black Community in Bloomington City Council Chambers. Representatives from the Monroe County Black Democratic Caucus, the Monroe County branch of the NAACP, and the city's Commission on the Status of Black Males are all expected to present their goals, concerns, and progress made in the city as it pertains to the African American community. The State of the Black Community takes place from 5:30 until 7 p.m. in Bloomington City Council Chambers. On Thursday, Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton will address the residents from the Buskirk Chumley Theater in his third State of the City address. That address begins at 7 p.m. and will be broadcast live on WFHB and CATS, Community Access Television.
NDOT's project manager for Interstate 69 Section 5 says work crews have moved more than 700,000 cubic yards of soil since the state took over construction in August of last year. The project manager, Sandra Flom, gave the update to the Bloomington-Monroe County Metropolitan Planning Organization on Friday. Flum says the soil move by the state in just 4 months last year amounts to 60% of all the excavation done in the nearly 3 years the project was managed by a public-private partnership. Flum also told the MPO the state has laid 226,000 tons of asphalt.
They had not been doing asphalt under the P3 in any meaningful numbers, and so we exceeded theirs by 115% of what had happened in the years prior. We had one very big day of asphalt, or 1 week, I should say, of 27,000 tons of asphalt. Obviously, that was a good weather week to be able to get all that down.
Section 5 runs along State Road 37 from just south of Bloomington to Indian Creek in Morgan County. Construction of the 21-mile segment began in 2014. The original completion date was set for October of 2016. That completion date was pushed back several times as construction slowed and international contractor Isolux Corson had trouble paying its subcontractors. The resulting delays prompted a state takeover from I-69 Development Partners in August of 2017. Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton sits on the MPO Policy Committee. He says he's grateful for the update Flum provided, yet remains frustrated. Hamilton pointed to the summer of 2016 when he says area residents and officials alike were frustrated with construction delays, yet officials could not get accurate updates on the project. He presses Flum as to why the state wasn't more helpful.
We were trying really hard, right,
yes,
to get. So why do you think it was so hard to get that information?
In a P3 contract, in the way that this was structured, the state was not paying bills. So the developer was paying the bills. Bills are generally paid by units. So if the contractor was moving 50,000 yards of dirt, that would be in the invoicing. And since that was being paid by a private entity, we weren't receiving that data.
So are you telling me that you couldn't find out from the P3 partner where they were on pace in terms of how many cubic yards they had moved during that three-year period?
For each time that you asked, we were asking, and maybe a few times in between those, we were asking as well.
And you weren't being told?
We weren't getting the data.
Did you have no rights under the P3 to be informed? Weren't they?
We did. And we were exercising our rights, which led to the decision in June to make that separation.
Well, I don't even think we got a report from you at that time from NDOT that said, hey, we feel your pain. We believe we are owed this data, and we don't have it. We think they're behind, but we can't tell you how far behind because they won't tell us, in which case we both could have stood up next to the highway rather than just me and say, why are these things not moving? Why are we so far behind? But frankly, I felt, I should just speak for myself, exceedingly frustrated that the state was not expressing the concern about the pace and the fact that information was not available. The state was expressing, I don't know how to describe it, but it was, I felt like I was beating my head against a wall of my fellow government entity with public taxpayer money going in here, we couldn't find out what was going on.
Indiana Department of Transportation's Tony McClellan says NDOT officials shared Hamilton's frustration because they too weren't able to get adequate information on the project's progress. Hamilton says he's not opposed to public-private partnerships, but says, quote, without transparency, it's just a recipe for disaster, unquote. This winter, work has slowed and traffic is flowing in all four lanes. Flum says that's about to change as the speed and volume of work picks up in March. She says northbound traffic on State Road 37 will be switched to the southbound side with only single-lane travel.
We are keeping an eye on the weather. Tony's folks are helping us with kind of anticipating weather events so that we don't put single-lane conditions in place unnecessarily when we know there's a weather event coming. But if the weather looks good come mid-February, we're going to go ahead and get traffic switched. It'll be a little different than last time. We'll have a little separation between the single lanes. We have more room on the southbound side that's just recently been built, and that allows us to do.
Flum says she expects traffic will be reduced to a single lane for about 4 months. She also says the Walnut Street interchange will close beginning March 1st for a 6 to 8 week project. Traffic will be detoured to State Road 46. Assuming average seasonal weather, Flum projects I-69 Section 5 will be completed this August.
Officials in Ellettsville are looking to consultants to develop a long-term financial plan for the town. Speaking in the town council's meeting last night, Council President Scott Oldman said, historically, the council has had what he refers to as a paycheck-to-paycheck mentality. Oldham says a 10- to 15-year financial plan will help the town plan for growth and give its employees a well-deserved raise.
And the townspeople deserve the best in services we can provide, and we're doing that right now, but there is going to be a need for growth. There's going to be need for more fire people. There's going to be need for more police officers. There's going to be need for more clerical staff. There is going to be a need as this community grows, and if we don't make the right decisions now, we are dooming some council years from now to make some incredibly tough decisions that we could probably stave off with a little bit of knowledge right now.
Utilities Superintendent Mike Farmer proposed contracting with consultants H.J. Umbaugh to develop the financial plan. The consulting firm has worked with Ellettsville previously on other projects. Farmer anticipates the consultants could provide a final report in time for the town's July budget sessions. Council members Kevin Farris and Scott Thomas voiced their support for the proposal. They say they're looking to the consultants to help the town use its tax dollars wisely and in a way that benefits the largest constituency. Town Clerk Sandra Hash agreed with Oldham's proposal.
We've got a base of 7,000 people here that are paying for everything we do, and we're doing a good job. If there is additional revenue streams out there that we don't know about, then yes, help us find them. If we can be better spenders of our money, help us understand that.
Hash and Farmer say giving the council and department heads a roadmap in the form of a financial plan will reduce the stress of budgeting. The council will begin preliminary discussions with H.J. Umbaugh in their February 26th meeting. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Residents of Bloomington spoke out this afternoon against the purchase of an armored car by city police. Dozens of reporters, local government officials, and concerned citizens gathered in the Bloomington Police Department headquarters at noon to ask questions of Bloomington Police Department Chief Mike Dekoff. Their concerns were largely that the $225,000 armored vehicle would be used against protesters and represented an increasing militancy among police forces nationwide. Dekoff repeatedly defended the purchase of the vehicle, saying it would offer protection for law enforcement, who routinely respond to calls featuring heavily armed individuals in Monroe County and surrounding counties. Dekoff highlighted the importance of such a vehicle in assisting a law enforcement in responding to a hostage crisis as recently as November, when an armed man took his wife and her children hostage. The following are highlights from this afternoon's press conference.
We'll go ahead and get started. My name is Mike Dekoff. I am the chief of police here in Bloomington. I want to thank everyone for attending today and welcome you to our department. On behalf of the mayor, he also wants to welcome everyone and asked me to respond today to citizens' concerns about the purchase of an armored vehicle for our critical incident response team. So what I wanted to do is give a little brief overview, and then I'll take questions from people. So starting in 2000, we had an incident that happened on Bluebird Lane where a male had started a fire in an apartment on the east side of town. He then went to his wife's a house on Bluebird Lane, broke in, killed her, and then went to the end of the street, was in the woods, and waited for a police response and started shooting at the police when we arrived. After that incident, there were some discussions about the need for protective equipment for our officers. And so we were able to secure an old Brinks bank truck that we made into a response vehicle for our critical incident response team. We had that truck for about 12 years, where it got to the point where mechanically it just wasn't sound, and it was basically just falling apart. So we retired that vehicle, and since that time have been without any kind of protection for our critical incident response team. During the 12 years that we had that vehicle, there were numerous occasions where we responded to high-risk situations where shots had been fired, where our officers were actually fired on when they responded to deal with those incidences. Since 2012, since the retirement of that vehicle, we continue to have incidences where our critical incident response team responds to high-risk situations and are fired upon. The most recent being this past November in Owen County, where we were called to assist in a domestic violence situation where a male had held his wife and two children hostage and fired numerous rounds, not only at her, but also at the responding officers. So that's a little bit of a background as to where we're at today. We've actually had a vehicle for many years. We haven't had one for the last few years because we just simply couldn't afford it. In 2015, there was a public safety local income tax that was passed, and so we were able to use funds to purchase a protective vehicle for our officers in 2017. It's actually being built and will be delivered in 2018, but that's where we're at. This vehicle started to be discussed in 2016. It was in capital replacement documents that the city had, where we obviously, for budget purposes, plan ahead. So it's been discussed for a couple of years. One thing that we are going to do is there is a document that we are going to make available on our website that goes into a lot more detail of the incidences and the need for such a vehicle that we will make available. You'll have to just get on the city's website and look for that document, but we'll put that front and center so that it's easily found. I want to talk a little bit about there seems to be some concern about it being used for protest situations. As I stated, we've had a vehicle since 2000. We've had many protests since that time period, and we have never used our armored vehicle in any situation like that. This vehicle is for our critical incident response team. They respond to high-risk situations where there are usually firearms involved, and the risk of people getting hurt is quite high. That is the only thing that this vehicle will be used for. We have policies that dictate how our critical incident response team is deployed. We have matrix that we go through. It has to meet a certain level before the decision is made to deploy that team. We are very cognizant of the perceptions of being militarized, and that is not what we are going to do. This is a response vehicle for emergencies and high-risk situations, and that is all that it will be used for. There's been lots of discussions about these types of vehicles being used inappropriately, and I will be the first to say I have seen instances where they have been used inappropriately. You know, I watched, things that happened in Ferguson and thought, what are they doing? And I've talked to actually lots of police leaders who have expressed the same thing. I don't know all the details of why they did what they did, but I think that here locally, you know, we've had one of these in the past. We've never used it or deployed it unless it was a CERT type call out incident. And so, again, that is how this will be used. So, you know, we're very cognizant to the community's perception about the militarization. You know, that's why when we looked at this, we looked at our alternatives. The vehicle that we purchased was that alternative. I think it's really important for people to remember this is a piece of equipment. It's not our mentality. You know, we're very cognizant to the community's perception about the militarization. You know, that's why When we looked at this, we looked at our alternatives. The vehicle that we purchased was that alternative. I think it's really important for people to remember, this is a piece of equipment. It's not our mentality. Yes.
Chief, first of all, I appreciate you for doing this. I understand that being a police officer always brings about some measure of danger. But in reality, we have other agencies nearby that are capable to help us in this situation. We haven't had many. I'm kind of disappointed that I did read the executive report, and I saw you public safety press conference as well. And during that press conference, you talked a lot about the metrics and the data that we collect as a police department. So when I set aside, an hour and a half to read this executive report, because I was expecting it to be reasonable data that supported this decision and this huge financial contribution from the city. But most of what I saw were a few anecdotal incidents that, well, as the gentleman said, this is Bloomington, and we just don't give way to passion. It needs to be logical, it needs to be thought out, it needs to be discussed and addressed. This is not just a civilian vehicle. This is a vehicle that, the United States has given the Syrian military to defend itself. It has the capability to be outfitted with cannons, with water guns, with M16s, something like that. But I just really am disappointed that this wasn't more of a community process. Everyone here wants our officers to be safe and appreciated. But at the same time, you're saying it's about safety. Okay, well, where are the metrics that show me that, hey, communities that have these vehicles are safer and that those citizens' civil rights haven't been infringed upon? You could say you could have the same argument for a drone that, we don't have a drone can make things safer. But at the same time, if we want a weaponized system flying above our heads, where is the logic?
I think I've never had to go and tell the spouse, a significant other of a police officer, that they've been shot and killed. I don't ever want to do that. In my mind, this is insurance.
Okay.
I've been shot at before. Being shot at is not something that is fun, let me just tell you, okay? And so the fact that I can take a step to protect my police officers, to protect people that they're responding to who've been under fire. The woman in Owen County who had been shot at by her husband with her children there, that is something she told our officers, he was going to kill me. And so, yes, it is passion. But the problem with this is that this is the least militaristic type of vehicle. I did not want to get an MRAP. I could have gotten an MRAP for much less. That was not what we needed here.
Does that data exist that he's talking about? The data that proves that these armored vehicles do what you said they do?
I don't know if there's been studies undertaken for that.
So
I don't know.
It's not based on data. It's based on what you...
It's based on our experience that our officers have been fired at, and we are trying to provide a safe alternative for them. There have been departments that have misused these vehicles. We've had one in the past. We've never misused it.
You have to ask you, you spent $250,000 on this vehicle, and you're saying you haven't done your homework to see those data there to support the decision.
I believe that we have done our homework. I believe that we have been in situations that have put people, their safety at risk, and this will minimize that.
You've been listening to excerpts from this afternoon's press conference at the Bloomington Police Department headquarters about BPD's purchase of an armored truck.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back at 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. My name is Scott Ferris. I am a sixth generation member of the Ferris family, and there's quite a legacy here of the Ferris family, and I'm going to talk about some of that. What I'd like to start off with is coming to Bloomington in the 1820s. My family was known as Covenanters. Covenanters really is an outgrowth of the Presbyterian Church, taking and going all the way back to Scotland, where my ancestor, approximately eight generations ago, was hung for treason. He was hung for treason because of his religious convictions and the fact that he was a Covenanter. The Covenanters actually believed, in contrast to the Church of England, that the king or queen was not the head of the church, and it was really Jesus Christ. And so, therefore, members of the church took a covenant, and a covenant really was to really be opposed to the rule of the king. This resulted in conflict. In fact, there were battles. And this is around Edinburgh, Scotland. My ancestor was captured. He was tried for treason. And as a result, he was hung at the gallows. So the Covenanters, as a sect, moved from Scotland to Ireland, and they were pretty much persecuted there as well. And given the opportunity, they immigrated into the colonies. In this case, there were five ships, all made up of Covenanters, and they made sail and arrived in a place called Charlestown. And, of course, that's Charleston, South Carolina, and they moved to a place called Rocky Creek. Now, understanding the colonies at that time, you had the aristocrats on the East Coast, you had the plantations, and then you had the frontier. And the Scotch-Irish Covenanters were given land right on the frontier. Now, this frontier butted up right against the Indians, and so they were kind of like the buffer zone, and they kind of protected the plantations and the aristocrats. The Covenanters in that time frame were abolitionists, anti-slavery, and of course, this is the early 1800s. They tried to do something which was not very popular at the time, and that is they tried to get anti-slavery legislation passed, and that didn't work very well for them. And so as a group, they migrated north to another frontier, which is Indiana. So this brings us to my ancestor who arrived in Bloomington, and it was James Ferris, who is my great-great-great-grandfather. James Ferris, his history is that when he was in South Carolina, he did graduate from college there, which is now the University of South Carolina. And from that, he got the calling, and he went into the ministry, and he was ordained a minister in the Reformed Presbyterian Church. Well, the Reformed Presbyterian Church is an outgrowth of the Covenanter sect of the Presbyterian Church. And he, along with a large number of other Covenanter families, and a gentleman by the name of Thomas Smith and Agnes Smith, moved via covered wagon up to Indiana. Now, Agnes Smith was the wife of James Smith. This is important because in Bloomington today, if you go over on Morris Pike and High Street and even Hillside Drive, there are two old brick structures there. One is the James Ferris House in Steer Park, and the other one is the Thomas Smith House over in Pickwick Place. Old brick structures. And when they were built out in that area, that was rural. There wasn't a whole lot there. Thomas Smith had a great number of acres, and James Ferris did as well. That's where you get Smith Road, and that's also where you get Covenanter Drive, and that's where you get the Covenanter Graveyard, which is on the corner of High Street and Moore's Pike. I have five generations of my family buried in that graveyard. Turn in next week, and the story continues. Thank you.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Don Guerra. Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That coming up next on WFHB.